Okay, I guess I have the signal to start, so let's begin. Welcome and thank you all for joining us this morning. My name is Muzaffar Chishti. I work for the Migration Policy Institute and direct its office at New York University School of Law. We are also being live video streamed this morning, so welcome to all of you who are joining us from wherever you are in the comfort of your home, your office, or assorted coffee houses around the country. So this morning, MPI is releasing a new report titled The Deportation Dilemma, Reconciling Tough and Humane Enforcement. I think it's no surprise to any one of us that immigration deportations have become a dominant story in recent past. Though we all know that the pace of deportation has picked up a lot in the last few years, there are two factors why there has been a sharp focus on this issue in recent years. Number one is with the diminished hope for immigration reform in Congress, the cumulative effects of the new historical reality of deportation has finally sunk in. And while this new reality has sunk in, it has also invited a significant amount of sharp controversy. Indeed, there are two competing narratives in the country today on this phenomenon. One suggests that we are not removing enough people, and the other would suggest that we are removing too many and too many wrong kinds of people. And in the midst of this controversy, the administration has announced that it is reviewing its policy on deportations. So we at MPI, without being partial to either of these two narratives, decided to take a sharp and deep look at the reality of the deportation phenomenon today. Indeed, sort of what does the picture of the landscape of deportations look like? On one hand, how do we place people in the pipelines for removal? And finally, through which processes and mechanisms do we remove these people from the United States? So numbers, many of these numbers have been out there in the press. This is the first part of our report, is to provide a more textured view of what these numbers tell us. The second part of the report is going to look at whether there are any policy options that could change the outcome of this deportation picture. This report of ours today is part of the longstanding commitment MPI has in understanding the immigration enforcement phenomenon writ large. Last year, we published and produced a report called The Immigration Enforcement of the United States, The Rise of a Formidable Machinery, a seminal report which looks sort of at the macro picture of immigration enforcement in the United States. Before that, we also did significant reports on the 287G program and the National Fugitive Operation programs. And soon after this report, in a couple of months, we'll publish a deeper analysis of the demographics of deportation, so stay tuned for that report also. But for today, we have the two principal authors of the report with us, Doris Meiser and Mark Rosenblum. Before I'm completely remiss, let me introduce the two junior authors of this report, Claire Bergeron and Faye Hipsman, who really were instrumental in bringing this product to the finish line, so we thank them and applaud them. And then we'll be joined by two respondents. Many of these people are well-known figures in the immigration debate. Doris particularly needs no introduction. She is the senior fellow and director of the U.S. Program here at Migration Policy Institute, and before that was the Commissioner of Immigration Service, and is a unique person in the world of immigration, both from policy and application point of view. No one has seen immigration enforcement and policy making up close as Doris has seen in her work in the administration, which spanned everything from Ford administration to the Clinton administration. She's always embarrassed about this, but for the purpose of this meeting today, she's famous for being the author of the Meisner Memo, which has now become the Bible on the prosecutorial discretion in immigration enforcement. Mark Rosenblum is the deputy director of the U.S. program here at Migration Policy Institute. This is Mark's third tour of duty at MPI, and for MPI, we hope this is the lucky one. Mark is a highly regarded political scientist who spent, before returning to MPI, spent two stints, one at Senator Kennedy's office and one at the Congressional Research Service, where immigration enforcement became his niche. And following Mark and Doris, we'll have two respondents. One is going to pin on this giant of a screen, who will be a giant of a legal scholar called Hiroshi Matamura. Hiroshi is a dear friend and colleague. He is the Susan Westenberg Prager Professor of Law at UCLA. But to most of you, he is known as the author of two major case books on immigration law and the author of a highly acclaimed and popular book called Americans in Waiting. But his new recently celebrated status comes from having been the principal author of a memo that was signed by about close to 100 law professors to the president before DACA was implemented to make the argument as to why the president had the authority to implement and authorize DACA as he finally did. Our last speaker today and the second responder is going to be David Aguilar, who has spent about, before he's today now partner with Global Security and Intelligence Strategies. Before that, he spent pretty close to 35 years in immigration enforcement. He was both the acting commissioner of the CBP and deputy commissioner of the CBP, and before that, chief of the Border Patrol. And more importantly, for this purpose, he's one of the few people who spanned in very important positions the Bush and the Obama administration. So very relevant for our discussion today. So with that, let me turn to Mark Rosenblum to get us off started with what you found.
Thanks. thank you, Moos, and thanks to people who braved the rain to get here. Moos, let me thank you for your guidance as we got this report done, and thank Michelle Mittelstaedt and everybody at MPI, and especially add my thanks to Faye and Claire for their hard and sustained work to get this report across the finish line. Definitely a team effort all around on this one. I'm going to start with sort of a 3 or 4 minute overview of what the whole report is about, and then I'll drill down and go through pieces of it in a little more detail, and then Doris will finish, take the last piece. So overall, what this report does is describe the evolution, the history of the U.S. deportation system for the last two decades. And we use the term deportation in this report to describe removals and returns, to describe all sort of forced repatriations out of the United States. So we focus on three drivers of deportation policy over the last couple of decades. The first driver is immigration legislation, laws that Congress passes governing immigration enforcement. The second driver is immigration enforcement appropriations. And the third driver is actions that the executive branch takes to exercise its authority and to make use of those appropriations to do immigration enforcement. This is a pretty thick report, if you have it in your lap. And most of what it consists of is to describe how those three drivers interact over time to shape deportation outcomes, to shape the deportation system over the last two decades. And we identify three key trends that have emerged over that time period. And they are that over the last two decades, an increasing share of all deportations are formal removals rather than informal returns. And I'm going to say more about all of these. The second overarching trend is that, focusing just on the formal removals, an increasing share of formal removals are non-judicial removals. They're executed just by DHS without going before an immigration judge. And the third key trend is that an increasing share of all border crossers face criminal charges in addition to whatever immigration charges they may face. So all three of these trends are ways in which the enforcement system has become tougher over time. They all predated the Obama administration. They all began before Obama came into office. They have all continued in the last 5 years. In fact, really, they've all accelerated in the last 5 years. So that's one set of findings. A second sort of overarching finding or overarching focus of the report is that in addition to those three sort of tough enforcement trends, the Obama administration has also recently implemented, recently articulated its explicit enforcement priorities and implemented guidelines for exercising prosecutorial discretion. I know that's why some of you are in the room today. Even as the overall scope of enforcement has increased. So one thing that this report does is sort of referee the debate between those who believe that this administration is the deporter in chief and those believe that President Obama is the releaser in chief. And what the data show pretty unambiguously is that both of those things are true. All three of the tough enforcement trends over the last two decades are ways in which immigration enforcement has been very tough under this administration, and this administration has implemented a record number of formal removals in the last 5 years. You know, the data are very clear on that. It is also true that this administration has taken unprecedented steps to focus enforcement on certain high priority cases. And the efforts to focus enforcement have mostly been successful. Most of the deportations, virtually all of the deportations, are of people who fall into one of the three categories that DHS has identified as enforcement priorities. The reason this report is called the deportation dilemma is that even this highly focused enforcement, when it occurs on a large scale as it has, and when unauthorized immigrants have deep roots within the United States as they do, even highly focused enforcement has a substantial impact on immigrant communities. As Moos mentioned, the administration recently announced a review of deportation policies to find ways to make enforcement more humane. But the other aspect of the deportation dilemma is that there's a fundamental tension between the two goals that the administration is pursuing. There's a fundamental tension between more humane enforcement and strict and tough immigration controls. Those goals are in opposition, and the administration is trying to do both of them, and you know that presents a real dilemma for how to implement policy. So the final section of the report describes some of the policies that are being debated, have been proposed, or being considered to try to, you know, do both of those things. And Doris will tell you about that after I go through sort of our findings and describe how the system has evolved. So let me begin with the first driver of the deportation system, which is legislation. And I'm going to focus on the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996, IRA-IRA. One of the main things that IRA-IRA did was to rewrite the provisions in immigration law governing the deportation process, governing informal returns and formal removals. So those are two ways that people can be deported from the United States. What informal returns means, or what an informal return is, basically is that someone is put on a bus or put on a plane and sent home. It's sort of the additional consequences of being informally returned are minimal beyond being actually deported. Formal removals are designed to have sort of more lasting and more severe consequences for the immigrant, and people who are formally removed are ineligible to return to the United States, even as a visitor, for at least 5 years, and in many cases for longer than that. And if they do return during that period, they're subject to criminal charges. So one of the main things that IRA-IRA did generally was to make it easier to formally remove people, to subject them to this harsher form of deportation, formal removal. And it did that in part by creating and expanding the pipelines through which people could be formally removed without appearing before an immigration judge, non-judicial removals. So prior to IRA-IRA, most people who were removed, and I'll say more about this in a moment, appeared before an immigration judge and had the opportunity to seek relief, and judges had the opportunity to grant relief on the basis of humanitarian considerations because they'd been in the country for a long time, they were the sole breadwinner, you know, they had U.S. citizen children for a variety of reasons. IRA-IRA generally restricted that process and made it easier for people to be removed and easier to be removed without appearing before an immigration judge. So that's a legislative change that's been a big driver of change in the system. A second big driver of change in the system is congressional appropriations for immigration enforcement. And appropriations matter sort of at two points in the process. They matter because appropriations determine funding for frontline immigration enforcement. How many Border Patrol agents are there? How many ICE agents are there? What kinds of technology and infrastructure do they have to do their jobs? How many, you know, drones and video cameras are there? And they also, and so that sort of determines how many people flow into the system by being apprehended. And appropriations also shape people's progress through the enforcement system, primarily when it comes to judicial removals, because appropriations determine the number of immigration judges, so how long people have to wait to get an immigration hearing, and also the number of the scope of the detention system, whether or not people are detained while they're awaiting a hearing. And the report sort of explains in detail how these things interact to shape enforcement outcomes. I'm going to mostly focus for the rest of my presentation on showing you pictures, because I think that they're nicer to look at than words and easier to describe. So what this picture shows you is that when you add all that up, the appropriations, there's a very tight relationship between spending on immigration enforcement and removals. So the bars in this picture are total appropriations for immigration enforcement, which we define as funding to CBP and ICE and U.S. Visit. And the line is the total number of formal removals. And, you know, as you can see, it's a very tight relationship. They're strongly correlated. I'm going to speed through some of these pictures, and I'm happy to discuss any of them in more detail when we get to the end or when we get to the Q&A. What this picture shows you is sort of the very macro level trends in immigration enforcement. This picture shows total apprehensions by Border Patrol, those are the blue bars, and by ICE, and before that by INS Investigations, interior enforcement, the red bars. And there's three things I want to direct your attention to in this picture. One is that total apprehensions are sharply down in the last decade. Apprehensions peaked, so if you add the red and the blue bars together, if you stack them, apprehensions peaked at about 1.8 million people in 2000. It's fallen by about two-thirds to 600,000 people in 2012. The second point is that all of this drop is on the Border Patrol side. All of this drop is fewer apprehensions at the border, which reflects fewer illegal inflows at the border. Border apprehensions fell 80% between 2000 and 2011 and leveled off in 2012 and 13. And the third observation is that while border apprehensions fell, interior apprehensions increased. They tripled between 2005 and 2008. And they've leveled off since then, but they're still double the historical average for this period. So what this picture shows you is total apprehensions. So this, the line in this picture is basically the sum of the bars in the previous picture. So everybody who's arrested by Border Patrol or ICE or apprehended by Border Patrol or ICE, that's the line. And what the bars in this picture are is total deportations. And total deportations or total repatriations is simply the sum of removals and returns. So the red and the blue are stacked on top of each other. And I want to tell you two things about this picture. The first observation is that over the long run, fluctuations in total deportations are almost entirely explained by changes in total apprehensions. So over time, you know, everybody who's apprehended, the same number of people are eventually deported. And that relationship is especially tight after 1996. You can see, you know, there was some gap before 96. Since 1996, that relationship has been very tight. The second observation from this picture, and this is getting to, you know, one of our key findings, is that historically, before 1996, the left half of that figure, the total deportations almost entirely consisted of informal returns. It's the red bars. And what you see since 1996 is that the blue bars have gotten, you know, to represent a larger and larger share of total removals. And you can see that even more clearly in this picture. And what this picture shows very clearly is that formal removals are an increasing share of total deportations. So historically, before 1996, formal removals never exceeded 5% of total deportations. 95% of people deported from the U.S. were informally returned. You know, essentially they were put on a bus or a plane and sent home. Since 1996, increasingly people are formally removed, you know, with these long-term consequences and being inadmissible for return and subject to criminal charges if they come back. And you can see in this picture You know, that clearly begins to tick up in 1996. You also see that there's a second inflection point. You know, the line gets steeper in about 2006, and that has continued in the last 5 years, that steep increase in formal removals has continued under the current administration. But, you know, one overarching takeaway from this picture, to the extent that IRA, that one of the goals of 1996 legislation was to increase formal removals, this picture shows that it was successful in that regard. As I said before, one of the ways that IRA accomplished that was by authorizing non-judicial removals as opposed to judicial removals. So an increasing share of people formally removed from the United States do not go before an immigration judge before being removed. They're removed just by DHS, previously by INS. And what you can see in this picture is that change was very much triggered by IRA. Before IRA, on the left, 3% of removals were non-judicial, didn't involve an immigration judge. Immediately after IRA, between 96 and 98, that percentage increased to 48%. And then between 1998 and today, it's continued to steadily trend up, with a little blip downward in the years when DHS was formed, but generally, you know, it's a very clear trend upwards. In 2012, the last year for which we have complete data, 75% of all removals were non-judicial. So 3% in 1996, 75% in 2012. It means that most people don't have a chance to appear before a judge. It means they never receive an NTA. So there's been some confusion in some of the research because people have been counting NTAs and citing that as evidence that ICE is not deporting people. But most people who are deported, who are formally removed, never receive an NTA and never go before an immigration judge. And this is a big change from how the system worked historically. This picture sort of gives a little bit more detail to describe the last two pictures. What this picture consists of is all removals from the United States since 1995. So if you add up all of those bans, that describes the total set of removals. And the bans divide it into the different types of removal. So that bottom band is judicial removals and a small number of administrative removals of aggravated felons, but mostly judicial removals. And then the next three bands in order are reinstatements of removal, expedited removals, and stipulated orders of removal. And the report goes into a lot of detail about exactly how these streams work. And it describes in detail exactly what successive executive branches have done to increase the scope of those removal programs, to make more, you know, to subject more people to those non-judicial removal pipelines. But the point to make here is that the growth in removal since 1996 has overwhelmingly been driven by these non-judicial forms of removal, particularly by expedited removals and reinstatements of removal. About 84% of the additional removal since 1996 are in those non-judicial categories. Okay, third key trend is that an increasing share of border crossers face criminal charges. This is another distinction to understand in how immigration law works, but removal may or may not involve an appearance before an immigration judge. But removal is a civil process. It's not a criminal offense. It's not a crime. Being deported from the U.S. Does not mean that you've committed a crime, and the removal process is not involve criminal prosecution. But there are certain specific immigration violations which are criminal offenses, included on that list. Illegal entry, crossing the border without permission, is a crime. It's a federal crime. That you can be prosecuted for. And that's been on the books since 1952. Illegal entry and illegal reentry have been crimes since 1952. But historically, prosecutors very rarely charged people with those offenses. And when I say very rarely, in 1997, about 1% of people apprehended at the border faced criminal charges for illegal entry or illegal reentry, 1% of the time. And that was the historical norm. It was actually lower, I believe, lower than 1% in most previous years. But you know, you can see historically 1, 2% of people face those charges. In the last decade in particular, that proportion has gone way up. So again, this is a choice of successive executive branches to use existing authority more aggressively to put people in criminal proceedings and bring these charges against them. And it matters because facing criminal charges is you know, a more severe consequence than simply being deported. People serve time in the federal penitentiary, and they have criminal histories and are convicted criminals by virtue of being convicted of these charges. And most recently, they have been named as an enforcement priority by virtue of having been convicted of these charges. So this is a third, you know, major change in how the system works. Another reason that these criminal charges at the border are important is because they have had sort of a large ripple effect, a large impact on the broader federal criminal justice system and federal court system. So what this picture shows, the blue bars in this picture represent the total number of immigration cases brought just in the five border districts, the five U.S. judicial districts near the border. And the red bars are everything else that federal courts and the federal criminal justice system do. So the blue bars, the immigration, has increased sixfold since 1997, from 15,000 cases a year to 90,000 cases a year. Everything else that the federal government does, in, you know, in terms of criminal justice, so, you know, child pornography, racketeering, drug smuggling, everything else that people can get charged for in federal court has decreased 10%. So 600% increase in immigration, 10% decrease in everything else. You know, this is, you know, partly reflects sort of the opportunity cost of bringing these immigration charges, these criminal charges against people. So far what I've described are these three trends of increasingly tough immigration enforcement. They predated the Obama administration. They have continued under the current administration. The other thing that's happened under the current administration is that the administration has taken a series of actions to focus enforcement on high priority cases that they've identified. And the high priorities that they've identified and explicitly described are people who have been convicted of crimes, non-citizens convicted of crimes, which are referred to as criminal aliens, recent illegal entrants, people apprehended at the border or people who entered the country illegally recently, and people who obstruct immigration controls. And that mostly refers to people who return after being formally removed, but also includes people who, for example, don't show up for a removal hearing that they have scheduled. The way that these priorities have been implemented is that we've seen very different enforcement systems emerge at the border and within the interior. At the border, virtually everybody is considered an enforcement priority because, you know, at a minimum, virtually everybody apprehended at the border is a recent illegal entrant, and many of them also may be reinstatements, and some of them also may have committed crimes. So at the border, all CBP confronts a declining number of crossers. Apprehensions are going down, as I showed you, but a larger and larger share of people and larger absolute number of people are facing formal removal and criminal charges. So it's an increasingly zero-tolerance system at the border where everybody who gets apprehended faces these tough, enhanced consequences. In the interior, it's the opposite pattern, where because ICE has new enforcement tools that expand its reach into the criminal justice system and into the community, there's a larger and larger pool of people crossing ICE's radar and being potentially subject to enforcement, but a smaller share of unauthorized immigrants are being placed in removal because most people that ICE learns of don't fall into an enforcement priority category. So I'm going to show you pictures that illustrate both of those trends. This is what the border looks like. At the border, the line apprehensions is going down. So apprehensions at the border are sharply down since 2005. But during that same period, The number of people, the absolute number of people subject to formal removal and criminal charges has increased. Those and also the people subject to remote repatriation, which is being deported through a different place where you entered or being deported deep within Mexico. So those bottom three bands are all going up. They're going up absolutely, and they're really going up proportionally because the total number of apprehensions is falling. And all of the drop in apprehensions results in fewer voluntary returns. So more people coming in, fewer people coming into the system, more people facing sort of higher stakes enforcement. Within the US, it's the opposite. The line, this is just focusing on secure communities. This is ICE's program for checking the immigration status of people who are arrested in state and local jails. The line represents people identified by secure communities, and the line is up sharply over the last 5 years. 500,000 people in 2013 were identified through secure communities. And the bars at the bottom represent the number of people, total number of people deported, both formal removals and informal returns through secure communities. And what you can see is that basically the number of people deported is staying flat and actually declined a little bit in 2013, even as the number of identifications is way up. So a smaller share of people identified through the program being deported. There's a couple of caveats. Not everybody in the line is removable because that includes some LPRs. And some of the people identified are still serving criminal sentences and will be deported in the future. But the pattern very much holds over time and you know captures the different dynamic that's going on in the interior. Let me now just take a couple of slides to describe sort of the overall impact of this of the enforcement priorities and exercise of discretion on what the demographics of deportation look like. What this picture shows is looking at the total number of people removed from the U.S., formally removed, how many of them had previously been convicted of a crime and how many of them had never been convicted of a crime. And what you can see in the sort of the left two-thirds of the picture, the left three-quarters of the picture, is that with the passage of IRA-IRA, with you know a big increase in formal removals, most of the increase in formal removals in the decade after IRA-IRA passed consisted of non-criminals, people who had never been convicted of a crime, people who now would fall outside of the enforcement priorities, you know, or many of them would fall outside the priorities. What this picture shows is that that trend reversed in 2009, and it's evidence that the enforcement priorities and the exercise of discretion have successfully refocused enforcement on people convicted of crimes. So since 2009, under the current administration, the number of non-criminals removed has fallen, absolutely. The number of criminals removed has increased, and the proportion of, you know, the ratio of criminal to non-criminal removals has gone way up. However, there's an asterisk that we have to attach to that finding, and the asterisk is that most of the growth in criminal removals, removals of people convicted of a crime, consists of people who have been convicted exclusively of an immigration crime. So it's basically the population I was describing a few slides ago of people, you know, charged with illegal entry and illegal reentry. 21% of all of the people convicted of a crime removed since 2009 were exclusively convicted of immigration crimes, and that represents most of the growth in criminal removals. And another 23% had only been convicted of nonviolent misdemeanors. So about half of all the criminal aliens deported since 2009 have either been immigration crimes or other nonviolent misdemeanors. Just to sort of wrap up. You know, the evidence shows that that enforcement has been robust. There's been, you know, has continued tough enforcement in the last 5 years, and that it's also focused on these priority categories. But even highly focused enforcement has a substantial impact on immigrant communities. And we talk in the report, you know, about some of the, you know, the various indicators of the rootedness. I mean, particularly enforcement that happens on such a large scale. And when unauthorized immigrants have deep roots in the United States, as they do today, large-scale enforcement has a you know significant ripple effects on immigrant communities. The Obama administration has announced its intention to find more humane forms of enforcement, but there's a fundamental tension between these two goals of doing tough, strict enforcement and doing it in a humane way. And I'm going to let Doris tell you about some of the things that are being discussed and some of the tools available to try to strike that balance.
Doris?
Okay, thank you very much. Well, pretty clear that what Mark has described to you is a very, very different system from the system that has been in place in gradually in years past. We're talking about a system now that can remove 400,000 plus people on an annual basis, plus or minus. And all of the other numbers, none of these numbers are incremental. They are transformational. These are very, very big swings that create a different historical reality. So the difficulty then in looking at policy and at trying to determine how you make adjustments based on the experience that's been displayed here is a tough one, because although it is the case, as Mark said, that border enforcement and interior enforcement are quite different systems at this point. They're not only different systems in terms of the way in which the enforcement is carried out, they're under the jurisdiction of different agencies. But when you get to policy, the interaction is deeper and deeper, so that what it is that is happening in border enforcement fundamentally affects interior enforcement in these trends with criminalization and with zero tolerance at the border as compared with the interior. So when you get to the discussion of policy and what the policy levers are, that is certainly going to be in the minds of decision makers. Touching this part of the system doesn't just create a straight line response, it invokes other parts of the system. Now, in line with the way in which we wrote this report, obviously the actors here are key actors. There's the Congress, there's legislation, there's appropriations, there's executive action. And certainly, both in the case of legislation and appropriations, those have been heavily influential in bringing us to the system that we have today. We discussed those a little bit, but realistically, in the near term, there's unlikely to be change there, so the focus is on executive action, and so let me focus also in the time that we have on the executive action parts of this. Where the executive action is concerned, as the slide that's up there shows you, we basically have four areas in which the administration can make some changes. One is in the enforcement priorities. So the enforcement priorities, from the numbers that we've developed and that Mark has shown you, actually have been working. This shift that the administration made to use prosecutorial discretion both in establishing enforcement priorities and then in the use of guidelines applied in individual cases has been succeeding. But that's a macro kind of a statement. Within those enforcement priorities, obviously there then can be questions, and certainly is debate, about whether those definitions could be adjusted and are what they might be. I think most likely the most obvious discussion surrounds the definition of serious crimes as the first enforcement priority. And on the issue of serious crimes, there is, as the data show, a real conglomeration. There are serious offenses and then there are minor offenses. So one of the things that could be done in tweaking the system is to make crisper definitions of what is really a serious crime. A good example of how that might work itself out has to do with traffic offenses. Traffic offenses is something that comes up regularly in the discussion. It's one of the things that is most of concern, where community impact and perceptions and probably reality of randomness are concerned. Traffic offenses could be divided into serious and non-serious. The most obvious division would be DUI, driving under the influence, retaining that as a serious traffic offense, but at the same time, minor offenses, the classic broken taillight, being treated in a different way as an area where discretion should be applied. So that's an example of the kind of discussion and the kind of change that could be made in the enforcement review that's taking place at the present time. But of course, there are arguments for other kinds of changes in the enforcement priorities, and probably the most commonly heard is the idea that immigration crimes, which would be entry and illegal entry and re-entry, that be eliminated as a serious offense. I myself think that it would be very unlikely, actually, for the executive branch to do that, because if you were to eliminate immigration crimes entirely from being called serious offenses, what you would really be setting up is a system that says, okay, we're going to make the border tougher and tougher and tougher, but if you can get across the border and you're in the interior, even if you've been a habitual violator, you're in a safe place. And that, of course, is a system that classically is a system that we have run as a country. But we've basically decided, both by actions of Congress and for all kinds of other reasons, that that's not a system that we, when I say we, I mean collectively, the public, the Congress, et cetera, want to have anymore. So I'd be very surprised if one sees immigration offenses simply dropped from the definition of serious crimes. But that's the range of the debate. I mean, I'm raising it as an example of the way in which the debate would likely be happening and the considerations that decision makers would want to be taking into account in deciding whether to tweak the enforcement priorities. There are lots of other examples, and you might raise them in questions, but where enforcement priorities are concerned, that's the kind of discussion. Another thing that could be done is to strengthen the way in which prosecutorial discretion is being applied, and there are a variety of things that we now know based on the experience of the current prosecutorial discretion approaches that could come into play. Probably the most glaring is to clarify the conflict between the enforcement priorities themselves and the actual exercise of discretion in an individual case. If you have a circumstance, for instance, of a border crosser who also has a U.S. citizen spouse, which prevails? How do you weigh that? Is it the border crosser that wins the day in terms of enforcement, or is it the fact that there is a strong equity in the U.S. that prevails? And that reconciliation for how it is to weigh factors hasn't been done, and the Department of Homeland Security certainly could give guidance on issues like that. There also is, with prosecutorial discretion, quite an unevenness that takes place in its application around the country. This is a classic problem of bureaucracies. This happens in many, many areas of public policy. It's particularly evident right now in the case of the individual application of prosecutorial discretion. There are lots of things that could be done by the department in terms of oversight to address that issue, and that would be a way in which prosecutorial discretion could be more effective and more evenly experienced around the country. There are other areas that have to do with CBP, whether in the Border Patrol some degree of prosecutorial discretion should be introduced. That gets to be a very tough issue in terms of trade-offs with what's taking place in border enforcement. My colleague might address that. But the whole area of prosecutorial discretion is certainly one that's on the table. Enforcement processes are important. Mark made reference to one that has to do with the federal courts and the Justice Department. There could certainly be a rethinking, as between DHS and the Department of Justice, about the degree to which prosecutors bring criminal charges for immigration violations. That too is very controversial, because those criminal charges being brought in border enforcement have, in fact, according to the data, been an important part of reducing recidivism and increasing deterrence at the border. But it is also the case that the downstream effects on the criminal justice system writ large. The district court system is very substantial at this point. So there might be some room for recalibrating in programs like Operation Streamline and other border operations that don't upend the entire success story of what border enforcement has achieved. Finally, of course, there's the issue of a broader action, a DACA-type action. Many people, of course, are calling for a broadening of DACA. DACA is also an exercise of prosecutorial discretion, but for a category of people and in a circumstance where individuals are allowed to apply for protection from deportation. Our next speaker, Roshi, is going to discuss the issue of DACA and the use of discretion in that kind of circumstance as a legal matter. I think it's fair to say that as a political matter, if the administration were at this point to do a broadening of some kind, it would severely jeopardize the possibility of any kind of movement on immigration reform legislation because of the strong political attacks from the Congress. Even DACA as it exists is a usurpation of congressional authority. So if there were to be a broadening, I would be very surprised that it would happen now while there's still considered to be some possibility of movement. That may not be the case forever, but that would certainly be, I think, what's in play at the moment. All of that adds up to where we started and to what it is that Mark has said, which is that it is extremely difficult to reconcile tough enforcement, the system that's been put in place and is performing in the way that it's performing today, with humane enforcement, so that whatever it is that the administration does in this review is likely to keep these questions open, controversial, and still in debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Doris. So we will now have two responses to this paper, and I'll go first to Hiroshi. Is Hiroshi joining us by video screen? Can we see him? Hi, Hiroshi. And
hey, good morning. Hope you can see me out there.
Yes, we can see you on the giant screen.
Okay.
So let me just.
I wish I could be there, but my I couldn't leave town. My students would be too disappointed if I didn't have their final.
Yes. We can't let that happen.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this. This is a really excellent report, and it's illuminating in a lot of different ways. And so what I've been asked to talk about has to do with the context for this in the sense of the setting for the developments discussed in the report, and in particular, the ways that one can think about prosecutorial discretion and how it's exercised. So let me try to address some of these things. I think that the first thing to keep in mind is what we call prosecutorial discretion is really just a small part of an overall system of choices. And Mark's comments and overview address some of those choices. I mean, of course, Congress makes a number of choices that we don't normally think of as discretion, but in a sense, it is discretion. But of course, it is in the form of legislation and in the form of appropriations and sometimes targeted appropriations. And then there's the executive branch discretion that we think about, but there's also, as Mark mentioned, immigration judge discretion. And even after that, you have discretion that is exercised to determine whether or not a formal disposition like removal order actually gets executed. But as he mentioned, I think one of the things that we have to understand is that in context that the picture for discretion is, I think, quite different from the situation before 1996. In 1996, you have an expansion of grounds for which people can be removed, but you also have a lot of reduction of back-end discretion in the immigration judges. And so what that means is that the pressure on the executive branch to make choices is far greater than it was, because it remains the actor with the greatest latitude given what the system the Congress has created. And it's a system, of course, in which we have 11 million people in the country without lawful status, much larger than before. So that's important to understand. This is the setting in which the president is exercising discretion. I think it has changed quite a bit, both as the scale, but also location in the federal government and executive branch, and in particular in DHS as opposed to the immigration courts. So what I should do then in just another 5 minutes or so is to try to put this in the setting of let me articulate some principles, I think, that are rooted in history and to some extent in the scant law that there is on this subject, and principles that I think we ought to think about when we think about the president's prosecutorial discretion. Six basic ideas I'll go through, and if there's time in the Q&A, I'd be happy to elaborate on any of them. The first is to understand that the real test is whether the president is really exercising prosecutorial discretion as opposed to ignoring the law. There's been a lot of back and forth on that, but I think it's important to understand that a criticism of a lot of initiatives like DACA seems to assume that when you're making enforcement choices and decide to prioritize some groups and deprioritize other groups, the assumption seems to be sometimes that the law is being ignored. And I think that's simply not true, that in the system that Congress has given us, with the great disparity between capacity and potential enforcement, that the reality of enforcement forces choices. So that's the first idea, that Congress really has, that the president really has to exercise discretion as opposed to ignoring the law. And I think that discretion is quite distinct from ignoring the law. Second idea is that to decide what's really discretion, as opposed to ignoring the law, is that the president cannot take over the core functions that Congress has in the immigration system. That means that the president cannot grant citizenship, cannot grant permanent residence, except in very narrow ways that are defined by statute, such as DHS granting waivers of inadmissibility and that sort of thing. But the president has to stay away from granting citizenship and granting permanent residence, and that's why I think that another important distinction is between DACA on the one hand and the DREAM Act on the other. The DREAM Act, of course, providing in its most recent incarnations a path to citizenship after a grant of permanent residence after a number of years. So that's the second idea. The third idea, I think, is also uncontested, and that is the president has the power to set priorities for enforcement. We've seen that most recently in the Morton memos and earlier. The appendix of the report has a very useful compilation or a list of citations to these memos, which are very much worth looking at for the picture they provide. It's clear that the executive branch can set these priorities, and if there was any doubt about that, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2012 in the Arizona versus United States case emphasized the huge role that the discretion plays and needs to play in the system. And so, of course, these priorities focus on groups of people, make them higher priorities or lower priorities for deportation, and there's a spectrum there. Some of the priorities focus on individuals and their attributes. Some focus on their relationships and the effects that deportation would have on U.S. citizens. And some priorities focus on context, of course. That could be foreign relations concerns, witnesses in labor rights cases, civil rights cases, and things of that matter. But I think fundamentally, and this closes out the third idea, is that these guidelines are important. No one doubts the ability or the power of the executive branch to set priorities. And these guidelines are intended to produce some order, some rationality, some uniformity, and some predictability to the process. Okay. The fourth idea, I think, that's worth bearing in mind is that goes back to the context here, the context of the enforcement, the big gap between the size of the unauthorized population and enforcement capacity. Guidelines have shortcomings, and I think the largest shortcoming that we've seen is that they're not necessarily followed uniformly. To make sure they're followed in the field requires constant and expensive vigilance. And that vigilance and those results will often be incomplete because it's always hard to uncover instances where patterns in the field are inconsistent, unpredictable, and perhaps even discriminatory. That could happen, for example, with ICE officers in the field or USCIS officers in the field or immigration judges that disregard the guidelines. And so the challenge, in having guidelines, is to make sure the discretion that the guidelines embody is exercised in ways that are uniform and predictable. And I think a couple of developments in recent years have increased the need for, or the challenge, I should say, for uniformity in applying these guidelines. One is that secure communities has increased the need to make prosecutorial discretion choices because of the number of people identified as potentially removable. Another that we've seen, this comes after the Morton memos in particular, has been some reluctance or even resistance on the part of ICE officers in the field that have made it difficult for the administration to assume that the relatively soft guidelines would be followed. And I think that's the context in which DACA arose as a way to not get away from individualized determinations. There are certainly individualized determinations being made in DACA cases. I want to emphasize that because that's part of discretion. But I think that what DACA represents is an attempt to ensure consistency in advance for a set of cases that ought to be a real priority for deportation, but were not necessarily be treated that way. So that's the fourth idea. Basically, is that the need for uniformity and predictability and administration, proper administration, justifies formalizing prosecutorial discretion guidelines into temporary renewable statuses that fall short of things that Congress can do, like granting a green card. Okay, the fifth idea I think is let me just acknowledge there's one harder question here. The harder question is, why does this temporary status like DACA, why does it grant work authorization? I think this is a harder question, but ultimately I think that the idea that I would come back to is that a couple of things. One is that denying work authorization under circumstances where people have been identified as at the low priority for deportation and not being deportable would greatly increase the harms to communities and to U.S. citizens. And ultimately, I think this is a judgment that people who exercise prosecutorial discretion have to make. And I think that the administration has done this on a humanitarian basis to say that if we're going to put people in this status, then it only makes sense to allow them the means to work and sustain themselves. And then finally, I think it's important in thinking, the sixth idea is in thinking about prosecutorial discretion, I think it's important to think about what is going on in Congress. Doris mentioned the cost that may come with broadening DACA. That's certainly a reasonable way to look at things. I also think, though, that the other thing about administrative action or prosecutorial discretion in general is trying to figure out how to preserve the status quo pending action by Congress. I think the other five factors I mentioned would be relevant even if Congress were not going to do anything. In other words, even if it were clear that Congress clearly will not act. But in this situation, another reason for or another basis or for thinking about prosecutorial discretion is that in implementing guidelines, to think about those individuals most likely to benefit from any legalization that Congress might enact. That really goes back to the guidelines, because the guidelines do tend to track the groups that would benefit from legalization. And I would add in closing that there's a long history of discretionary relief being the precursors of statutes, and discretionary relief being exercised in ways that anticipated congressional action, some of which actually happened, some of which did not. But in any event, I think it reflects the judgment that as long as it is a live topic, as it certainly is in Congress, it ought to be reflected in the guidelines as well. So that's just been, you know, six ways to think about prosecutorial discretion. And I think that's a way to think about the question of when is the president exercising discretion doing so in a way that is certainly not ignoring the law, but trying to administer a system that is obviously very challenging to administer.
Great. Thank you, Hiroshi, and thank you for joining us so early in the morning in Los Angeles. And stay on for, we may have questions for you. So we'll turn on for the last speaker of this morning to David Aguilar. Chief, you kind of lived this progression in deportation in your various stints. So just share with us quickly, what are the operational imperatives or constraints
of the exercise of prosecutorial discretion.
Thank you, Your Honor. And first of all, I want to begin by thanking the Institute and all of those who were involved in putting this paper together. A tremendous paper. And the reason I say that is because I had this discussion with the commissioner this morning. This captures the measures and metrics of stats, the data that is so critical in order to add the brushstrokes to this picture that needs to be painted of what is happening in this nation as it relates to, in my case, I portray it as border control, of which immigration control is a critical aspect of it. So adding those brushstrokes is absolutely critical. Now, from the operational perspective, we have to be very sensitive to the actions taken in the different systems within the overall immigration system. When you mentioned, when the Meisner document on prosecutorial discretion was mentioned, that kind of sent shivers down my back because I was there as a regional chief of the Border Patrol in Dallas, Texas. And the ruckus that it caused was tremendous amongst those of us, and I include myself, that were in charge of border enforcement. But progressively, we recognized, and I speak for the rest of the chiefs and the rest of the operators to some degree, that there was an understanding that prosecutorial discretion had a place within the overall system. Now, there were some of us that were a little more receptive, others that weren't, and so forth, but we have progressed. We have evolved, and we have continued to move forward. Now, one of the critical things that I think needs to be pointed out is any actions taken relative to prosecutorial discretion as it relates to direct border enforcement, that's probably the most sensitive area that we have to be attuned to. Because any action taken down there as it relates to prosecutorial discretion is going to be, I think, necessary, but it'll be very tight in how we apply it on the immediate border. The reason being is that the vast majority of the folks that we deal with down there are, in fact, illegally in the country in the immediate border. Even within the 100-mile area that we cover, as it relates to Border Patrol operations and ICE operations on the border, I'm going to say that 99% of the individuals that we apprehend within that 100-mile zone are either immediate crossers or in-transit crossers that have just crossed the border illegally and are moving towards the interior of the country. So, yes, prosecutorial discretion is a piece of that enforcement system on the immediate border, but we need to be very careful with how it is applied there. Now, the overall immigration system, I classify it as border enforcement system, interior enforcement system, and then I would break it down into the actual communities within the interior. The communities being those that reside, those that domicile, those that basically live in our country, and then there's the criminals that live within our country. So each one of these, we need to basically take a look at how we take each one of those individual systems and figure out a way to address the system of systems that we're dealing with currently as a country. Now, having said that, we have all seen, I believe, the tremendous swings that we have taken as a country, swings that are driven by the environment. By the environment as it relates to the country being knowledgeable about overall immigration, overall border control, overall things that people align with immigration and with border control. Think about this for a minute. In my case, when I entered the United States Border Patrol, first of all, in 1978, there was very little interest on anything having to do with the border. It was actually, people didn't care about the border. The country didn't care about the border. We lived the upswing where all of a sudden there was an interest on it. There was reaction to that. There was IRCA of 1986. There was prosecutorial discretion. There was IRA. We called it IRA Square. All of these things that were basically reactions to the current environment. Now, where we're at today, in my opinion, we have gone from basically a high interest of this country to high interest on border control, to what now I think is turning into a high interest on illegal immigrant control within the country. You turn on the news right now, CNN, Fox, anything else, and you hear about the border literally only in passing. What is capturing America's interest right now is this interior, which is constituted by communities that I described, communities that live in the country, criminal, and so forth. So how do we dial up the capabilities, the abilities that we have as a country, and dial down in order to bring that balance to the overall system? That's our challenge today. That is critically our challenge today. But again, we have to recognize that we are literally still reacting to the environment in which we live. Now, the debates that are occurring today, I mentioned this the last time I was here, the debates that are that we're always hearing are those of the humanitarian debates, critically important. The economic debates, absolutely we need to be talking about that relative to immigration reform and border control. Legalization, then the political one. But the debates that we have to have, and I don't know how we do this, is we have to go to that comprehensive debate relating to the immigration system that this country needs. And that's going to be tough to do as we move forward. Now, the consequences. Yes, we started focusing on the consequences from a border enforcement perspective that could be delivered. The system that we have is a consequence delivery system that we put in place in order to bring a set of controls to that uncontrolled border. We saw the results. Now, was our economy a part of it? Yes. But I believe that the consequences that we applied in a manner that was necessary to the flows that we were facing at the time are a big part of how we brought the border to the level of control that it is now. And I always say this, when it comes to border control, yes, illegal immigration is a critical aspect of border control, but we cannot forget that the overwhelming nature of the 1.6 million, 1.8 million apprehensions that we had in 2000 are a loss of overall control of the border, which gives leeway to the cartels, to the criminal organization, all the other bad players, those that exploit these people that are coming across the border, those that put them through these deserts and through these mountains where they freeze to death or they dehydrate to death. So bringing the border under control to the level that we have now, critically important. So therefore, applying the consequences within the realm of what we had the ability to do was critically important as we move forward. Now, the aspect of prosecutorial discretion we're talking about, and it seems to be capturing the attention of the nation right now, as opposed to border control, which was 2 or 3 years ago the highest level of interest. That being the case, what we need to take a look at is, one, that it is but one component of the overall system and how it is applied. I was telling the commissioner this morning and Hiroshi that right now prosecutorial discretion is in danger of being treated like the fence was 6, 7, 8 years ago. You all will remember that the border fence, there were some groups that were saying that is the solution, that is the only thing we need to do, that is what needs to be applied, we need 2,000 miles of fence. We were one of the most vocal ones, also in enforcement, saying no. The fence is but a component of the approaches that we have to take in order to bring the level of control that we have. So I would just caution us that prosecutorial discretion, along with all the other components of the immigration system, are what need to be taken into consideration. Some dialed up, some dialed down, and bringing that balance within the capability that we have today. I know I've run out of time. I will only say one other thing because I think it's appropriate. Again, the report, this is a great report. I would only add anecdotally, reconciling necessary, tough, and humane enforcement, because necessary is a big part of the system that we need to address. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So we have a few minutes left this morning for some questions and answers. So those of you who want to ask questions, please raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you. But just do remain warned that we are being live video streamed. So you will be watched by people on video if you don't want to be noticed. So first, any questions? Volunteers for the first question?
Congratulations on an excellent report. It really encapsulates a lot of interesting trends over the years.
Could you introduce yourself?
Stuart Verdery, Monument Policy Group. Question I had was, I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing, but I didn't see anything about kind of enforcement at the ports of entry in terms of, you know, international travel, those types of things. And I'm wondering, I think that's one of the key aspects of what's being debated in Congress is entry, exit, and what we do with individuals that are identified as not having left, entered legally but did not leave. And I'm curious as to how that fits into this debate and what your theories are on how we go after overstays that maybe are recent but accumulate over time and create the problems that you identified?
Thank you, Stuart. This is that there's not a lot of attention to that in this report. Most the sort of scope of the report was defined around the deportation system, and as you know, very few people are formally removed at ports of entry. We do discuss withdrawal. You know, what often happens for people who attempt to enter illegally through a port, if they're identified as, in many cases, they withdraw the application, and it's like a voluntary return where they leave as a low consequence. There's only, you know, in the low tens of thousands of people who get formally removed from ports of entry each year. But to your sort of more general question of the issue of overstays and how they enter the enforcement system and get removed and what resources go to that, most of the interior enforcement that goes on today happens through secure communities and related programs to identify people in jails and prisons. So an overstayer who gets arrested for whatever reason is going to get picked up through that system. Sort of at-large overstayers who are in their communities and don't commit a crime and keep their nose ground down and go about their lives they're not viewed as an enforcement priority right now, and there's not a lot of systems in place to go after that. I mean, there's the ICE has a fugitive operations program, which could potentially find people like that, but again, they're not even, you know, if they haven't ever come before an immigration proceeding, they're not going to be defined as a fugitive either. So under the current system, that's not viewed as a high enforcement priority. And I think your point is well taken that that's sort of a gap. And if the goal is to sort of address the whole unauthorized population, that's a subpopulation that sort of falls outside of most of the scope of today's enforcement system.
Mark,
I would associate those overstayers with immediate border enforcement from the following perspective, that if we're not careful, again, taking the entirety of the system into consideration, we know for a fact that about 40, and depending on which studies you read, 40 to 45% of the people illegally living in the country entered this country by legally and just overstayed. So a system, to have a system in place that is able to identify those that come into the country and literally overstay and identify that in the immediate time frame and prioritize those, I think would be a value to this current immigration system. Because if you don't, then they embed in the community, and if you find them 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, they have the equities and the things that are so sensitized to everything else. So I would suggest that having that immediate enforcement capability to identify and take the actions required within the first 6 months to a year would be of value to the current system that we have.
Overwhelmed.
Would you silence the crowd? There's one of the at the back, Lisa.
Hi, Emma Buckout, Latin America Working Group. Just wondering, mostly for Mark, in the course of doing your report, you mentioned sort of the remote repatriations. Were you able to look at that at all and sort of the trends that have happened over the last few years, especially, or if that could be any part of the possibly deportation review, what we're looking at that in the future?
We didn't really look in detail at that, and I don't, I'm not sure, I mean, so as you're suggesting with your question, these remote repatriations have been somewhat controversial, because what most of the remote repatriations consist of is somebody who's apprehended in Arizona, for example, might be deported through Texas or through California. And they've been controversial among immigrant rights groups because, you know, people get deported into a community where they don't know anybody. They may not have, you know, they may have lost their documents or their money along the way. And so, you know, it creates some bad humanitarian situations. This report doesn't go into detail into this, but this report does describe some data that CBP provided us on recidivism rates broken down by different enforcement consequences. We actually don't look at the remote repatriation in this report because it just was a little bit outside the scope of what we're doing. But the other reason that remote repatriation is controversial is that there's not really evidence that it reduces recidivism. So it definitely has some costs. Its benefits are a little less clear. I know that, I think that there are people who are looking at it for those reasons, but it's not really within the scope of this report.
Okay, anyone else? He's the right chair.
There's a lot in this report, though.
Hi, Nick Medeiros with Delta Policy Group. Ms. Meissner, you alluded to this, but do you have any sense of to what extent the increased criminal enforcement is resulting in the drop in illegal entries versus the changing economic conditions of Latin America and the U.S.?
Well, that's one of the issues that makes it so difficult for policymakers, because the data on the use of criminal charges in border enforcement show that it is effective in reducing recidivism and considerably more effective than most of the other enforcement measures that are used at the border. That, of course, has to be weighed in the case of, as I tried to suggest, in the case of activities like Operation Streamline against downstream costs for the criminal justice system, the Justice Department, et cetera. So there's a very valid debate that can take place, ought to take place, about weighing those factors. But just on its own, the criminal sanctions are in fact an important factor in what the Border Patrol has achieved with recidivism or with reducing recidivism.
There was one in the back.
Hi. My name is Tania Sweat. I work with the National Day Labor Organizing Network. And the report states that an expansion of DACA would bring immigration reform to a halt. And I think that assumes that immigration reform is going to move forward. But in case it doesn't, is there recommendations around what executive actions the president can take that would minimize the harm for immigrant communities?
Yeah, it did not make recommendations in this report. The policy section of this report is a discussion of the range of things that are likely in play and where we think there could be an impact if changes were made. I'm certainly not in a position to pronounce one way or another on DACA and the point that you've made about the assumption that anything is in play is, of course, a whole discussion in and of itself. But I am just making the point that, as an observer, and all of us in this room are observers on this process, that clearly would be the most controversial thing that the administration could do right now. That's not to say it might not do it at some point, but my sense is that probably not right now.
I'll just add one thing, if I may. So we don't make recommendations, as Doris said, but we do go through in that policy lever section and describe within each of the different categories that Doris mentioned a pretty wide range of, sort of options that are on the table. And there are quite a number of ways that, within each of those categories that you could do a lot of dialing up or dialing down. So just as an example, you could redefine the priorities, quite narrowly if you wanted to. And what the record shows is that would reshape things. You could redefine the enforcement process, for example, to scale back non-judicial removals and to put more people in judicial proceedings. And that would, add to the kinds of due process that people go through and result in much, because that's a much more expensive and time-consuming way to remove people, would result in many fewer removals. There's a lot of trade-offs in each of those things in terms of sort of, the enforcement benefits, in terms of from an enforcement perspective that you get from it. But there's, depending on how you read the politics and how you weight, there's quite a lot of different things that can be done, that including DACA, but a lot of things outside of that kind of approach.
Well, and let me just add to that. And you could even maintain the enforcement priorities as they are now, but introduce a degree of screening, depending on where the apprehension took place, in order to determine even within the current priorities, where there might be people that have greater equities, where those equities should be more fully taken into account. One of the things that is so dramatic about the numbers here is the extraordinary shift to a system of removals that come about through expedited removal and reinstatements, where there is no real opportunity to look at possible differences among people. Screening mechanisms could address some of those things without ever even changing the enforcement priorities. So, you know, just building on what Mark has said, there are a range of there's quite a spectrum.
Hiroshi, do you want to jump on that question?
Well, just to endorse Mark's call to look at that last part of the report, I think that's a very excellent rendition of some of the options. And I would also emphasize what Doris just said, which is that there's this notion that DACA involves some kind of a blanket grant that's not individualized. I think that's an exaggeration in the sense that I think DACA does call for individualized determinations, but as Doris just mentioned, one could have a system that was involved more individual assessment of equities, but involved some of the virtues of DACA with regard to making sure that the guidelines are followed uniformly, not just uniformly and consistently and predictably, but also at lowest administrative cost, that is to say, avoiding the greater costs of undoing deviations from guidelines.
Mm-hmm. A question here.
Hello, Chris Rickard with AMU. I just wanted to ask you to elaborate a little on the recidivism. I noticed that the judicial removal is by far the lowest recidivism, and I wondered how that fed into the criminal implications. And also, the recidivism being defined as same fiscal year, does that strike you as unusual?
Mm-hmm. So Chris is asking about a table that's on page 35 of your report, and it relates to your earlier question also. So the reason that the judicial removals have such a low recidivism rate is that compared to the other forms of removal, expedited and reinstatement, is that judicial removals involve people being put through that longer process. So people in judicial removal, some of the people put in judicial removal successfully get relief from removal, and so they don't become recidivists because they're admitted into the country. Some of the people in judicial removal are detained for a long period of time awaiting a hearing, and they don't become recidivists because they're in detention. And some of the people in judicial removal are not detained and may or may not show up for their hearing, and so some of them also don't become recidivists because they become absconders, they become immigration fugitives. So there's a lot of ways that people in judicial removal may sort of drop out of the enforcement system, either officially or unofficially, and so it sort of is, you know, the recidivism rate is sort of artificially depressed, you know, compared to those other forms of removal. It's a reason that, you know, just to push back on my comment a moment ago, there's real cost to shift, you know, there's some real enforcement advantages to expedited removal for people for whom it's appropriate, because they get quickly removed. You know, they don't have this prolonged, expensive process that may not result in the removal of somebody who should be removed, you know, under current law. And then in terms of the other half of your question about, you know, how recidivism is measured, I mean, you're right that somebody who's apprehended in September and becomes a recidivist in October won't show up as a recidivist in the data, or right, because, yeah, September 30th. So, you know, it's an imperfect measure for that reason. And it's probably accurate to say that in general, recidivism underestimates recidivists for that reason. But consistently over time and consistently across those different enforcement pipelines. So, you know, you should understand that, but it probably doesn't change the findings that we draw from, you know, looking at those different types of consequences.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you to all of you who joined us this morning and on the video stream. This report will be available and downloadable on our website, migrationpolicy.org. Let's all thank all of our panelists this morning with a round of applause, okay?
www.migrationpolicyinstitute.org. www.migrationpolicy.org.